Doctor Who, Short Trips. Trap for Fools. Written by Stephen Fuhr. Read by Mark Strickson. Neil! If he was to survive, Turlough would have to think fast. In all their travels across the universe, monstrous foes and fatal encounters, few were as subtly dangerous as his current predicament. After all, he was new. As the voice echoed across the room, he did everything he could to locate its target and commit that person to memory. "Yes, sir," came the reply from the boy sat beside him. Neil was freckled and pale with a fringe that shaded watery eyes. As Turlough quickly filed him under no threat, Lanky Hamster somehow got caught in there too.
"Magason!" "Sir?"
Shiny Forehead was also sat on the same row of desks, and met his appraising glance with the flash of a challenging stare. File under threat, thought Turlough.
"Richards!"
"Sire?"
He could hear Fat Smirker shift awkwardly at a desk behind him, and Turlough joined in as his colleagues turned to stare. Richards was pretending to open his books, busily oblivious.
"It's always the class clown. Sir will do, Mr. Richards. We are not Plantagenet knights."
The sarcasm was embraced with a swell of sycophantic laughter.
"Yes, sir. Sorry, sir."
"Roderick."
"Sir."
Tricky one. A fast, enthusiastic reply from the periphery of the room. Turlough labelled him Rugger Lad for now and had to move on. At least he was not the only redhead. That was helpful. Any uniqueness here would be seized upon and used against you. He knew from experience not to look too good or talk too wise.
"Williams! Williams!"
Silence. No reply. Turlough wondered if he should use this opportunity to explain that his name had been skipped. But as the silence dragged on, he lost that impetus.
"Has anyone seen Williams? Anyone?"
It was impossible to tell whether the silence meant no one or everyone knew where he was.
"George!"
Specky Boffin No Threat sprang to his feet at the front of the class.
"Run to the office and see where Williams is. There may be a message from Matron or the house mothers. 5 minutes!"
The absence had visibly annoyed Mr. Homer, who seemed to like a clean column of ticks at the start of each class.
"Sir, you've forgotten Turlough, sir. He's new."
Mr. Homer glared basilisk-like in his direction, as if his very presence threatened the collapse of civilization. He looked down at the register, as if staring at it hard enough would rewrite reality to obey it. He would clearly prefer things if Turlough were not here at all.
"Here at St. Neot's Refuge, we believe in tradition, values, education and the betterment of self. We are a community devoted both to study and excellence. So it's always with regret that we receive news someone has chosen to leave that community."
Mr. Johns paused for rhetorical effect. Each morning after chapel they had to assemble for one of his homilies. The theme was usually honour, or noble conduct, or trying your best. Although today an air of theatrical sadness was being broadcast, amplified by the horseshoe of sad-faced masters behind him. Mr. Johns looked over his horn-rimmed spectacles.
"After long discussion with his parents and heartfelt consideration, Williams has elected to move on from St. Neot's to pastures new. We wish him well in all his future endeavours."
A ripple of whispering gripped the room, but it was firmly quashed before Turlough could distinguish any distinct concerns. With students drawn from across the galaxy, surely it must be fairly standard once in a while for someone to move on. They could always write to him.
"Finally today, the beginning of this summer term."
Summer, he thought. Another affectation. Strictly speaking, seasons, months and days here were created by a computer-controlled, reflective satellite, the Sky Mirror.
"Sees us welcoming several new boys to our first year, and throughout the school. We will all do our best to help them find their place here.
What am I doing here?
As Turlough lifted his hand to knock on the blue door, it suddenly swung open. He only narrowly avoided rapping his knuckles on the doctor's cheerful features. That may well have made him feel better. He was livid.
What am I doing here?
Of all the places in space and time they could travel to, the doctor had brought him here. St. Neots may be a refuge from the universe, tucked away in the communications blind spot caused by Diaz World, where they could both rest and recover from their adventures. But Turlough wasn't buying that. The whole place was, after all, modelled on an English public school. The very sort of place he'd joined the doctor in order to escape. There must be more to it. Mind you, the doctor certainly seemed to be relaxing. The role of groundsman suited him. Moving between morning lessons, Turlough would often catch a glimpse of him in the far distance, rolling the hockey pitch, riding astride the hover mower, or simply relaxing in a striped deck chair as the artificial sunlight dried the white angles of the cricket square. He even looked at home with the long beige work coat covering his cricket gear. None of the sporty types like Roderick had even noticed the new groundsman's hut that was so squarely upright, blue and bijou. Turlough only had a brief half-hour each day between final period and the scheduled return to the boarder's dorm in which to make himself scarce and pay a quick visit to the doctor. Today he was already turning to hurry away before he realised the doctor hadn't really answered his question. The idea suddenly struck Turlough that all this might be some sort of punishment.
Who makes a pact with the devil in return for free access to all knowledge of pleasure in the world?
Several hands shot up. George's buttocks danced with certainty on the chair in front of him.
Turlough?
It's pronounced Turlough, sir, he corrected, abandoning any desire to answer the initial query.
The name is Celtic in derivation, I believe, and therefore properly pronounced Turlough.
But, sir, Mr. Homer was implacable. Faust on hold while this particular struggle for a soul played out.
Remind me, Turlough, which one of us spent 5 years studying classics and Terran etymology at Corpus Gaiae?
Neil's reedy elbow pressed into his side in a way that insisted don't push back. Turlough knew, even as he hesitated, that his rueful reply of, sir, meant henceforth not even his name would be his own.
Magason, Matron called from the door of the dorm.
Turlough watched as Magason's grip on a first former's ear, whom he was currently attempting to bully into polishing his shoes, melted into a cheerful hair ruffle and a wink of bonhomie. Matron was fussily oblivious. There's a letter from your parents. Here.
You too, Roderick.
Magason smarmed over to her to receive it, as the first year scampered off reprieved. Turlough watched from his bed as the two boys sat for the half hour before lights out, neither seeming to show emotion as they devoured the letter's contents. Turlough was suddenly overcome by the desire for his own. There were no computers, phones or face mails here. It was one of the things that had appealed to Neil's parents, the pale boy explained from the bunk overhead. It meant that students could be brought up in a safe haven, beyond the reach of the relentless intergalactic babble of news, propaganda and communications. To Turlough, that had seemed like a hard rule to maintain. He turned his pillow at right angles and pulled it into his body firmly. His mind, he realised as he drifted into a sleep, no longer acknowledged the gesture as a hug. Neil's head appeared, hanging down from above like a strange, torchlit fruit.
It's not a rule, Turlough.
There were plenty enough of those, Turlough had cause to reflect the following day. Mr. Stabbing had caught him running past the war memorial and consigned him to detention.
These men died for us, Turlough. They sacrificed their lives so you and I could stand here today enjoying the freedom to study and exercise our minds and bodies.
The memorial itself was a dark wood lacquered board attached to the wall outside 4B, alongside ranks of monochrome school photos.
Columns of gilded surnames recorded the fallen of something entitled the Scarsdale Rose Bricks Wars.
Didn't you take history at your last school, boy? The attention span riots of 3016 are one of the reasons this very school was founded. Xenobiology Lab 2. Tonight.
Turlough was the only one here, and it troubled him to be alone with Stabbing. He felt the need for a potential witness. Every so often, Stabbing would mutter darkly to himself and flit off into the technician's room as he prepared his classes for the following day. There wasn't even a lab window to look out of. In all the classrooms, windows were built strategically high up the wall, so there was light enough to work without a view to distract. Nothing to provide escape from the boredom of a Stabbing lecture on Chlamydomonas or 2 long hours of detention. Turlough abandoned the lines he was writing. Using the fountain pen right-handed had always made his inky fingers ache after a while. Looking up, he realised he had been left alone. He paused and listened. Somewhere came the distant sound of a centrifuge or fume cupboard. A calculated risk. Silently, he lifted the lab stool from its position at the bench beside him to a spot beneath the nearest window. Warily scaling its heights, his fingers could easily grip the dusty lintel beneath. In the gathering gloom as the sky mirror passed out of phase, he could just make out the cricket pitch. But the spot beside it where the TARDIS once stood was empty. No doctor. A noise behind him made him jump down from on high and dart back to his place, head bent over the page with sudden feigned intent. As he heard Stabbing re-enter the lab, he dared not look up. Rationally speaking, Turlough knew there was no reason to fear this slight, waxy-faced man with his latent favouritism for athletes like Roderick and waspish disdain for all others. But something about him stirred some primal instinct for obedience, that shared desire to please or to fulfil the demands of a teacher. A sudden donkey bray of noise jolted Turlough from his page as Stabbing dragged the lab stool across the parquet back to its place at his elbow. He froze involuntarily for a second. Stabbing's breath brushed his ear as the man whispered,
"Very good, Turlough. Do me 100 more.
Turlough's insides caved with anger and frustration as he fought to contain the show of emotion, not to give any satisfaction to his jailer. "Of course," he replied easily, straining to deny the teacher any flicker of rebellion. His spidery writing returned to the page, resuming its repetition of the school motto for the 253rd time.
Scientia sit insatiabilis bellua.
That night, when he climbed into the lower bunk, there was a letter from home after all. "Turlough, can't be here right now. Nothing to worry about. Something's come up. Thing is, there are dark times coming to this galaxy, Turlough. Dark times, and even darker deeds. It's too unsafe for me to write herein what they may be, but they will be sanctioned and in some cases perpetrated by just a handful of people. Over the next 50 years, every Imperial leader, from the outer colony worlds to the Earth President himself, will have studied at this single school. Everything leads back here. And who better to get to the bottom of things, Turlough? Just the man. Schools, villainous plans, put all your experience into practice. Because if you want to change the future, Turlough, why use a time machine? If you want to change the future, to claim the future, use a school. The Doctor. P.S. If you get a chance, can you replace some divots in the hockey pitch after tonight's match?"
"This is not a democracy, Mr. Richards. We are reading Sartre in the original. Normally it was an effective strategy. Involve Mr. Clicker in a debate."
"Sir, why do we have to study languages in the age of translation software?"
"For example. And you could easily find yourself receiving an hour-long lecture without any necessity for concentration, work, or, crucially, completing any homework. For today's lesson, Richards has suggested a vote on reading the set text in translation. Having been foiled, he would invariably resort to spit bombing. His desk at the back allowed him scope to propel chewed pellets of damp foolscap towards just about anyone, catapulted from his bent plastic ruler. Turlo dreaded the thought of that sudden wet slap on the back of the neck. The next time Clicker was lost in reading, he sought a weapon from the desk in front of him. Releasing it from the chewing gum which held it shut at one corner, Turlo levered up the lid and quietly slipped his hand inside. Feeling about, he identified a ruler and slowly slid it out of the desk, rescuing his fingers as Neil beside him hurriedly pushed shut the lid. Clicker had looked up, and as the French philosophy droned on, the ruler sat untouched for the rest of the period. Only once it had finished did Turlo notice the name of its owner. The capitals had been carefully etched into the plastic with a compass point and illuminated in black marker. Williams.
So you took this ruler from a form room desk?
The requested meeting with the headmaster was not going well. Turlo had an inbuilt suspicion of authority, and there were times he thought it could only be less evident to others if he wore it on a T-shirt or tattooed it on his face. Neil had embraced the mystery eagerly, encouraging Turlo to voice his concerns directly.
That's not the point, Headmaster. Why would Williams leave without his things, his books, his diary? Why would he not take them?
Sir, it wasn't theft, Mr. Johns, Neil added.
We are not in a Conan Doyle short story, Mr. Turlock.
Do not seek to involve others in your rich and varied fantasy life. If you crave excitement, perhaps you would both care to join Mr. Stabbing for a week-long detention cleaning the xenobiology glassware?
Turlo didn't bother with the divots. In fact, he made a few more on his journey to loiter beside the cricket pitch. A square of flattened grass betrayed where the TARDIS had once stood, and there he waited, until he was almost tired of waiting. The distant clatter of applause indicated another Roderick triumph on the tennis courts.
Of all places, of all times, Doctor, Turlo found himself saying aloud, why did you have to send me back to school?
What if there was nothing more to it, he mused on his journey back. Perhaps in the end there was no grand evil master plan at work here. Nothing but people. Demanding, difficult, lonely people. That and a time-honoured system that bred and bullied privilege into you at the expense of all feeling and human sympathy. After dark, Magerson held court in the dorm, the torchlight glinting off his shiny forehead. The thing about poor people, he was saying, is that if they couldn't be bothered to educate themselves, they had no right to a better life. Same with aliens. That's why they were always trying to invade. Not that they'd find St. Neots hidden away in shadow as it was. George was in agreement. Stabbing, he claimed, had said there was some genetic factor at play. Laziness was in their DNA, so they couldn't help it if they were too hideous or stupid to earn a living. They weren't even useful on the front line as soldiers. Turlo had heard it all before. On Earth in the 1980s, so avoided getting drawn in. At least back then there had been some scholarship boys. As if in response to his inactivity, the torchlight swung towards his bunk.
It's people like you, Turlog, make it worse, you know. Befriending boys like Neil, how's he ever going to learn to toughen up with you holding his hand all the time?
Turlo shielded his eyes from the beam, which blinded him from the fact that the arrogant tones were coming nearer. An instant later, he felt hands grab him in the darkness and hold him down where he lay. The brightness dazzled as the bedsprings above his face began to creak as in protest. Neil was crying out as Magerson struggled to pull him down from the high bed by his ankle. As he resisted, clinging on to the metal rung of the bed frame, Richards whooped with delight at the fracas.
Life's not a game of cricket, Magerson spat. If you want something in this universe, you have to take it.
Although surprised by the speed of the sudden physical onslaught, Turlo rallied. Footing Magerson in his pulpy midriff, he shook off the tight hands gripping his wrist and shoulders, rolling out of the sandwich space between the bunks. Roderick was stood solid at his elbow.
Outnumbered, George and Magerson withdrew, leaving Neil dangling, sobbing, his pyjamas half-mast. As they settled into feigned sleep, unsure if the long, lonely night would tempt further assault, Richard's laughter still rang out. There was a code of silence between St. Neot's boys, which meant telltales were discouraged. Reporting someone for rule-breaking or intimidation was dangerous, and risked a life of ostracism or ridicule. So it was something of a surprise next day when they were joined by Richards at detention. Turlow didn't ask why he was there. He presumed someone must have told the head of house something of the night before's events, and Richards had been scapegoated as the loudest. He sat in Turlow's former place, on the lab stool opposite Stabbing, slowly scrawling his lines. Neil and Turlow were sent to join the lab tech in a side room, scrubbing long pipettes in the sonic shower. The repetitive task almost felt like a gesture of trust, and Turlow was cheered by the presence of the supervising technician. He was pleasantly distinct from the grueling intensity of daily lessons and sports games, bookended by time alone in the hellish boarding house. Of a sudden, something smashed to the floor. Richard's horrid, strangled cry springing from the lab next door startled Neil into dropping a conical flask. The glass shattered, blossoming outwards on the hard floor. Then, as Turlow watched intrigued, it began to tremor and tremble its way towards the wooden door that separated the two rooms, skittering under the sill to the lab beyond. The technician turned in haste to locate the scream, pushing Turlow backwards with a sweeping arm. But as he grasped the lab doorknob, it twisted and buckled beneath his grip, the whole door giving way under the pull of some powerful force beyond. Clinging onto the lintel for dear life, the technician was being sucked after it. Neil and Turlow braced themselves to avoid tumbling after as a buffet of rushing air pelted past them. Hold on! The very colour itself was being forcibly pulled from the anteroom. Turlow's whole gaze turned monochrome, the technician's face over his shoulder a twisted, desperate grey. Richard's screams were hard to distinguish now, amidst the blizzard of objects smashing in the maelstrom. Retorts and instruments flew past, but cutting through it all, Turlow heard the boom of a voice.
Mine!
It rumbled.
Mine!
The technician could hold out no longer. Losing his grip, he screamed out as his entire body was inexorably pulled into the vortex beyond. Turlow would surely be next. As his body was tugged, ever horizontal by the sheer force, he struck out with a flailing leg. His foot glanced the glass door of a fume cupboard, juddering beside the entrance where it stood. The door flew open, back toward the adjacent door lintel, the suction forming a hasty seal. Immediately, the powerful wind dropped, their limp bodies and a myriad objects crashing to the floor. Safe from its reach now, and through the toughened glass of the fume cabinet door, they could both make out what stood in the devastated lab beyond. When he finally found him, the doctor was in the cricket square, digging up dandelions with a long-handled screwdriver. "Where have you been and what are you doing?" Turlow spluttered angrily. "The weeds get in the way," blinked the doctor. "Misdirect the ball. Ruin the game." Turlow was speechless. "You have to dig right down to the root, you see," shouted the doctor to his departing back. "Otherwise it just grows back, hence the screwdriver." But Turlow wasn't listening. He was out of here, stumbling, running across the pitch towards the open door of the TARDIS. Sanctuary. Escape. Seeing his destination, the doctor hurried after him, calling his name. Staggering over the threshold, Turlow understood why. He was standing in a groundsman's hut. The gleaming, daylight-bright control room was nowhere to be seen, and in its place was the shelved interior of a small room, crammed with paint pots, worn-out tools, corner flags and folded goal netting. It's, he gasped.
It's not bigger on the inside.
Together they squeezed into the blue hut to whisper their shared intelligence. Crouching on a stove, the doctor explained how the TARDIS had first vanished, then returned. When it did so, it had been like this. Breathlessly, Turlough in turn described what they'd seen in the lab.
A figure, you say? Queried the doctor, flicking through the pages of his umpire's notebook.
Yes, like a silhouette or a shadow thrown on a wall, pulling everything towards it, into a sort of grey vortex, churning, unfathomably powerful, like decompression in an aircraft cockpit.
Like this?
The doctor's notebook held a picture. The grey graphite outline of a human shape with a radiating whirl of objects hurtling towards it. Hurriedly, the doctor sketched a speech bubble from where its mouth should be. Mine, it added helpfully. The entitlement, the doctor explained, are a gestalt entity, a sort of sentient dimension. Hidden in the silent places of the universe, the entitlement waited, ready to snatch any chance to claim things as their own, to possess and to consume. They are a person, or place rather, where nothing exists. No colour, matter, no creative thought, nothing. Hence their need to consume, to annex everything they see, a desire they honestly believe to be right, to be their right. Hence the entitlement. Although dependent on willing human hosts, the doctor reasoned, much like the TARDIS, every silhouette was a doorway, a bridge to another dimension. Bit by bit, the time machine must be trying to hide away, simply for safety's sake.
Because if the entitlement consumed the TARDIS, shuddered the doctor, nothing would be beyond the reach of their appetite.
Stepping out of the hut onto the playing field, Turlough himself shuddered. The crude drawing had underplayed the full horror of the creature in the lab. What had it done to Richards, to Stabbing, or the technician? As if as a further reminder, a sudden rush of wind hurtled past his frame, forcing him to brace himself from being tugged backward. The straining screech of the TARDIS engines, as though painfully resisting some powerful force, filled his head. When Turlough turned around in search of reassurance, both it and the doctor were gone. Hut, hat, screwdriver and all. The very next day, first period was xenobiology. As the boys headed up the stairs to the lab, Neil glanced at him sheepishly. But Turlough was not shocked when they found the lab practically untouched. When they had left yesterday shinning down a drainpipe from the technician's room, it had been chaos, the entitlement triumphant at its centre. Now it lay in stillness, Stabbing at its head. What had the doctor said? A willing host?
Good morning, gentlemen. Take a seat, he hissed. Thank you, Mr. Roderick, for your assistance.
The athlete had emerged from the tech room with a prepared tray of slides, apparently helping out in the absence of the lab tech. If all was normal, however, Richards was notably absent. Like Williams before him, his effects were all still within his form room desk, but he had vanished.
After long discussion with his parents and heartfelt consideration, Richards has elected to move on from St. Neots to pastures new. We wish him well in all his future endeavours,
went Mr. John's farewell speech the following assembly.
As a goodbye gesture, his parents have sponsored the Richards Prize for Contribution to School Morale, to be presented for the first time at Speech Day next week.
From that day, things returned to normal. But Turlough still battled to contain his anxiety surrounding the vanished TARDIS. Not content with their human victims like Richards, had the entitlement claimed it as theirs, he wondered? How long would it be before they manifested once more? Stabbing certainly was more harsh and driven than ever, but that may have been because the xenobiology practical was approaching, and it was 35% of their final grade. Before long, speech day was nigh.
And still no sign of the doctor.
Winner of this year's Will and James Dutton Prize for Good Sportsmanship is...
Mr. Homer, melting quietly in the confluence of artificial summer, canvas marquee and tweed, paused on the podium for dramatic effect.
Abel Roderick!
The flame-haired sportsman bounded up to retrieve the tiny cup. The tent was packed with red-faced boys, dizzy with both the end of term and heat. Some had brought their parents, who nestled under hats at the edges of the marquee, and along the open sides fringed with jingoistic bunting. The war memorial board hung darkly over the trestle of prizes, glittering beside the speaker's rostrum. Mr. John's opening address had been his traditional invocation of good sportsmanship and endeavour as badges of civilised manhood. He could have read the shipping forecast and received the same polite clap. Now he was brandishing an envelope.
Before our guest speaker today, we have one final prize to give out. Now, the Richards Prize is unique. Not only as it commemorates a highly spirited young man who left the school earlier this term, but also because it recognises the individual contribution a student can make to the morale of the whole school, staff and boys alike. Without further ado, I award the first Richards Prize to Wislaw Turlog.
A united gasp of disbelief filled the tent. Everyone was clearly as shocked as he, thought Turlough, as he moved forward to collect it. Halfway to the podium, he realised that was not the reason for it. There, beside the headmaster, stood Richards. His skin and uniform were an ashen grey, as if he had escaped from one of the black and white school photographs that hung in the cloisters. With an inrush of air, he groaned,
"We are the entitlement you ask!"
Turlough blinked in horrified realisation. It was always the class clown. Mr. John staggered back as through the tent flaps, monochrome students filed in from every angle. Names were muttered in recognition as their figures stalked through the crowd towards the dais. Turlough made out Williams amongst them. Soon, 15 or so had silently gathered, flickering with a baleful grey lustre.
"Mine!"
Richards croaked. Further voices joined the chorus, and troubled parents began to look round in consternation. As the cry spread, John's emptily mouthed orders. Turlough realised with no little horror that one by one other boys in the crowd were also stood, greying as they rose, colour draining from them as they joined their former colleagues.
"Mine,"
smiled Magerson somewhere to his left.
"Mine,"
joined a ghostly George floating upward in front of him.
"Where are you, Doctor?" gasped Turlough.
As if in response, a figure pushed its way through the throng, his red hair vivid against the dulling host, Roderick. Veins bulging, he fought his way to the front of the dais, his mouth opening wide in a grotesque, fish-like circle. Turlough noticed with horror that the colour was leeching from Roderick's body, running down his outstretched arms into the host around him.
"Ours!"
he bellowed triumphantly.
"We are the entitlement! We are few! We are many!"
Mustered as one now, Turlough could no longer make out individual boys' features one from another. A hot wind stirred as the group began to strobe and flicker. Mr. Clicker bolted, struggling to flee against the rushing tide of air. Surrounded by a sudden blizzard of stray hats and tumbling chairs, he was drawn ever backward into the now swirling grey vortex that pulsed before the figures at the heart of the tent. Then, with a shriek, he was gone, swallowed. Stabbing was fast on his feet, wiry frame braced against the onslaught as he escaped to the edge of the tent. Wind caught the envelope in John's hand, from where he too was backing off towards the exit, carrying it to Turlough's outstretched hand. Recognizing the doctor's rounded handwriting, he tore open the envelope. "Cover your ears," it read. As if on cue, screaming filled the tent. Like a broken light bulb, the sun had gone out. Somehow, the entitlement must have swallowed the sky mirror itself, he panicked. Deprived of light, boys and parents were blundering about in the darkness, in a chaos of noise and movement. Disorientated, Turlo could hear the entitlement drawing further victims towards their doom. He felt a tug on his blazer in the gloom. "Cover your ears!" he shouted to Neil. But it was too late. Nothing was securely fixed to hold onto in the makeshift venue. In the blackness, Turlo was struggling to find any stronghold against the combined pull of so many entitlement. He fought his way over to one of the sturdier uprights, but the tent pole was soon groaning and bending beneath his fingers. It was only a matter of time before he too succumbed. Doomed. At that moment, a hailstorm of noise shattered the tent. A collapsing Babel Tower of languages, flecked with flashes of machine code, rent the air. The piercing burble of the communication lanes tore through the tent on the field at St. Neot's. Every face mail, every picture, live feed, corporate security channel from the universe outside raged around them. Accustoming to the dark, Turlo made out the figures of the entitlement at the marquee's centre. They were stumbling and distended now, their human silhouettes battered and bulging like grey balloons. He looked around for weapons, anything that he could use against them in their weakened state. Desperately, he grabbed a two-handled cup from the ground and flung it towards the sputtering vortex. On impact, the effect was immediate. "Never mind the entitlement," he shouted to Neil amid the din. "Let's give them a taste of meritocracy!" Catching his meaning, Neil joined him by the upended trestle, and together they snatched up further trophies from where they had fallen, hurling St. Neot's Speech Day prizes towards the bloated grey heart of the tent. Every impact was visibly weakening the entitlement. "Here's 50 years of maths excellence!" yelled Neil, flinging a stray goblet after several fellows. "Take the Spencer Cup for spelling!" Turlo added. Held paralysed by the raging data storm, the entitlement could only buckle and burp beneath the onslaught. Cups for sport, drama, bravery, literature. 100 years' rewards for conscientious endeavour found their target. "Here!" yelled Turlo, meeting triumph as he had disaster. "Have a taste of individual sacrifice!" He and Neil lifted down the heavy war memorial. Together they flung it with all their strength. As it lifted and span through the air towards the now fading entitlement, it landed with a deafening finality. Those gilded names, thought Turlo, had saved their peers a second time. When the sun came back on, the doctor was there, smiling at the crease, dazzling in his cricketing outfit, just in time for his speech. "I repurposed the Sky Mirror as a communications satellite," he beamed. "Reset the hostile action defences with my trusty screwdriver. Then, once it felt at a safe distance, a few nudges from the TARDIS computers helped channel a galaxy's worth of data right down the entitlement's distended throat. Interfered with the real-world interface. Broke the link with its human hosts for long enough for you to finish it off, Turlo. Quick thinking, that, by the way." Neil was dumbfounded. Had they really defeated that remorselessly powerful horror? "Ha! Fancy an end-of-term friendly? Always have one on a speech day." The doctor grinned, polishing a ball on his cricket sweater. "First prize, the Earth and everything in it. Tea and buns for all." Turlo was shocked to discover that, strangely, he had no appetite. Later, on the TARDIS scanner, he watched as St. Neot's burnt into glowing fragments of cinder. "All back to normal," smiled the doctor, tossing his screwdriver like a glib majorette. "Mind you, never seen the Hads do that before." Turlough watched staggered. As the doctor fully restored the sky mirror, it burst into life with a destructive pulse of sunlight aimed squarely at the planet below. He stammered in reply, but it's the end of term, Turlough. Everyone's home for the holidays. Well, apart from the groundsman and the caretaker, that is. He gestured to two figures slumped on the floor of the restored control room. We'll drop them off somewhere nice when they wake up. You have to get right down to the root, you see, Turlough, the doctor continued, worn wisdom steady beneath the young man's face. Otherwise, it just grows back.